It's episode number 268 of The Way I Heard It, and this one is called A Place for the Placeless. Not exactly a direct quote, Chuck, but close.
Yes. What does it reference exactly?
Well, our guest, the very special Selena Zito, who always has a place in our heart, writes a column called The Middle of Somewhere.
The Middle of Somewhere.
Yes. And at some point early on in the conversation you're about to listen to, you will hear her talk about the importance of geography and the importance of moving for any number of reasons, and the way in which she believes many Americans today have become untethered from their origin. I think she's talking about a time when everybody had a place, but now many people feel placeless, and I just thought it was a nice turn of phrase. So I've turned it into the de facto title of this episode, which, by the way, is, I think, probably much, much better than the title.
Well, it would have to be, wouldn't it? No, just kidding. But what this is really about is the article that she wrote where she quoted you multiple times. I believe it's called Pennsylvanians Feel Left Out by Biden's Student Loan Policy, which is about the debt forgiveness that's going on. And it gets a little spicy, doesn't it?
Yeah, it does. And to be clear, this is not a conversation simply about that article. But what happened was the policy came out, and as you've no doubt heard, people with college debt are being relieved to the tune of $10,000 to $20,000, depending on your income. A lot of people are upset by this, in particular people who went to college and paid off their loans. And in my world, the kinds of people that I've been featuring on Dirty Jobs and the kinds of people our foundation assists, they're the ones essentially being asked to write a check. And so I wrote about this on Facebook. It turned into a thing. Selena wrote an article, and it's been read by millions of people. I'm not going to let this go for personal reasons. But I just think Selena is one of the most interesting people to talk to about this because, as with everything else she writes about, she's got a front row seat to the issue.
Yeah, she's an excellent writer, and she always goes to where the story is. I mean, when we had her on the podcast previously, whenever that was, 7, 8 years ago, I believe the episode was called Don't Fly Over the Story. That was an expression she used because she always drives. She makes two trips across country every year. One is east-west. One is north-south.
Correct. She's from Appalachia. I mean, that's her beat. And so she's written hundreds, maybe
from the Paris of Appalachia, which is western Pennsylvania near Pittsburgh.
Yeah. She's awesome. If you haven't heard of her before, you should really check out her column and just start with the conversation we're about to have right now. Selena's about as real as it gets. She's not a political animal, but obviously it's impossible to really write about anything today and not find yourself right in the thick of it. So it's a fun conversation. We touch on a lot of different things, including my mom, who's become friends with Selena in the course of getting her book out there. So it's always energizing, really, to talk to somebody like her. She's pretty fearless in the face of a lot of what's going on, and she doesn't pull her punches.
No, she does not. She's a straight shooter, but she's a very fair writer. I mean, the article that she wrote about the student loan debt, I thought was pretty well balanced. Like you said, a lot of people read it. She got, I forget how many millions of clicks, but she got clicks.
A lot.
Clicks
a
galore.
Lot. Yeah, because this is an issue that affects everybody. So, you know, strap in. There's some debt. There's some school. There's some coal mining. There's some forgotten notes from a Baptist church. There's talk of mentorship. There's a lot of meat on this particular bone, The least of which is not fiesta wear, which you're going to learn about. It's not fancy underpants. It's it's something a lot more useful. It's episode number 268. Did you have a final thought, Chuck?
My brain is as empty as the day is long, Mike.
Well,
you may
then
proceed.
Without any further ado, it's a place for the placeless, where Chuck would be quite at home. Right after this. Selena, I just met a girl named Selena. And suddenly, anybody ever sing that to you before?
Okay, so that's really funny that you brought that up, because my sister's name was Annette Marie. And so West Side Story came out when I was a little kid, and they were singing that song, Maria, all the time. And I was like, why isn't there a song about Selena? Why is it Maria? And so my dad would sing it to Selena.
I had no idea. I love that. I also love the fact that, like, if you're in a room and it's crowded and you hear someone shout your name from across a crowded room, Selena, like the odds that they're talking to you are extraordinarily high. Whereas for me, Mike, right, eight guys yank their head around. No one knows. Anyway, you're special.
When I went to school, everyone's name was Mary Margaret, Mary Elizabeth, Mary Catherine, Mary Mary. I mean, and then there's Selena. When everyone else had bologna sandwiches and I had pepperoni and crusty bread. And so it's still that way. Selena still is special.
I always ask this, not always, but when I find people with singular names, I always wonder, do you think your life would have been materially different had your name been Betty or Elizabeth? Do you think you'd be doing what you're doing now, traveling all over the back of beyond, writing the way you're writing?
Yes. Now, if I didn't have this hair, that might be different. But I don't think my name has ever defined me, but because I'm looking from the inside out, right? People might think that looking from the outside in. But I think I would always be the same person, not because of my name, but because of like my family. Now, if my family had been different and all the sort of wonderful, crazy, chaotic things that went along with being a Zito, I would have probably been different.
Well, for folks listening to this for the first time, Selena Zito writes a terrific column called From the Middle of Somewhere. And we've had her on the podcast before. The first time I saw her was on a cable news show, and I was on after you, I think.
Yes.
I think it was Tucker Carlson, and I just remember him saying, Selena Zito's up next. And I was walking out to get a cup of coffee before I came down here to Zoom, and I thought, what will Selena Zito look like, and what will she have to say? So it was your name that pulled me back to my computer. And then it was, of course, your many prescient thoughts and observations on the human condition that made me a fan. And Chuck, have you read her latest screed?
I have, yes. I wouldn't describe it as such, but yes. Yes, I have.
What's the difference between a screed and a rant, then? You do a great job, Selena, of making your point respectfully, going to where the story is. But I'm talking now, of course, transitioning roughly right into the whole student loan thing, which you've written about. And I detected a tone of exhaustion and are you kidding me in your words? Was I reading too much into them?
No, you're not reading too much into it. That comes from personal experience, but even more so, it comes from the people that I cover, right? I live in Western Pennsylvania, sort of the Paris of Appalachia, and where I cover goes from there out. So across the Midwest, down south through Appalachia, into Texas, all the way out to Utah and Colorado. And the people that I meet, because of the way I report, I travel along small roads, back roads, either old U.S. routes or state routes, to find what's going on in the country. Because that's who I cover, and I'm not focused on a readership and or people that I write about living in big cities, these are the people that are most affected by what Washington does, no matter who is in charge. But this one was in particularly very sort of frustrating because it was the government doing what they do, well, either best or worse, in that they were choosing one section of the country to be successful, one part of the people to be more successful and to be rewarded.
Yes.
Rewarded for what my parents would say would be bad behavior. And that is taking out a loan and then relying on other people, often other people that already repaid their loan and or never went and took out a loan, but found success in their life. And we're talking, of course, about student loans and the Biden administration's decision to forgive student loans up to $10,000 to $20,000, as long as you don't, your salary doesn't exceed $125,000. And surely people that I cover either didn't go to college and or went to a trade school or went to community college and or went to a four-year or got a higher degree, but paid their bill off. And now they're turning around and looking at their neighbor or their nephew or their cousin, you know, the person that works at the insurance company, and they're getting a $10,000 to $20,000 bonus, a freebie. And it's like, it's absurd. It is the theater of absurd.
As you know, this one hit pretty close to home for me. The people you're describing in the beat that you've embraced are by and large very similar to the people I've featured on Dirty Jobs over the last 20 years, the people you'll find on How America Works that is currently in production now. And of course, there's no greater corollary than to the 1,700 people that my foundation has awarded work ethic scholarships to, people who affirmatively do not wish to go to a four-year university but want to learn a trade. I'm mindful of the fact that I'm biased, and maybe you are a little too, given your roots. Okay, so we just admit that. But it's still awfully interesting to me to see the general sense of outrage around this, as opposed to the great bailouts in 2008 and 2009. Right. I'm still pissed off about the banks getting away with it. I'm livid. And when I write about this on Facebook, Selena, the student debt thing, people were like, well, where were you in 2008? I'm like, well, I was right here, still outraged.
Still pissed off.
Right.
Yes. And so what makes this different than every other decision the government has made to call winners or losers or encourage one kind of behavior over another or put their thumb on the scale? Why has this resonated so deeply with so many people?
Well, first, I think we both should clarify is that we do have a bias towards this, even if it's a scooch. Mm-hmm. But that bias is based on geography, not on politics. That's based on where we're from. That's based on place, right? We are a country of the place and the placeless. And I believe that your bias is probably very similar to mine. We both started out in community college. And so we have a sense of place and where we come from, but we also have a sense of our, of that sort of pool, right? You drop a pebble into the water and you watch the circle go out. We have a sense of that circle and we can see those people to the left and right of us who all did the right thing. And the people, I think to your then larger point, is why is this one so hard? Because the people that benefited from the most are the elite. And the people that are hurt by it the most are the people that go to the elite's house and fix their air conditioning or fix their
plumbing. So you have carpenters and HVAC people, plumbers who are going in and paying off the loans of doctors and lawyers and things.
Exactly. It's very tangible. Right? Yeah. You can feel it. And it makes us feel resentful towards the people that are getting this and who we naturally wouldn't be resentful for. We like our doctor. We need our lawyer.
Right.
But now this is divisional politics at its worst in terms of pitting us against each other. And by the way, there's a resentment that the elites feel towards the people. That's the part that really rubs me. That they are entitled to this money. And there were several people that I interviewed for the story that I didn't even put in the story because I thought, oh, geez, I don't know if you really want to put that out there.
You know what? I want to ask you about that because as I read it, and by the way, full disclosure, I'm in this story. You called me and I gave you some quotes. I tried hard to pull my punches for the same reason I'm trying hard now. I'm just pissed off. Selena, we literally, and Chuck had a front row seat to this, we just gave away $1.6 million in work ethic scholarships to roughly 300 men and women across all demographies, united only by two things, their willingness to work and their decision to forego a four-year path.
Right.
And for that, for that, they're getting a pie in the face.
Yeah.
They feel like they're chumps. I'm not trying to get out of my lane, whatever that means anymore, but I read, not in your article, but somewhere, that 80% of the people who work in the White House right now are going to get money back as a result of this. And so it is hard. I do my best not to make it political. But when everything is political, how do you not point that out? And how does it not make you go, whoa,
yeah,
wait?
Yeah. There were, you know, and I tried not to make the story overtly political. There were several people that, well, there were several people that I didn't put in the story, but did help me with background in terms of trying to understand the sentiment. And there were several people who told me that they believed that they were entitled to this, and then it didn't go far enough. And then there were other people who, this one decision, this one thing, this forgiveness, which, by the way, it's not forgiven, we're paying, we're footing the bill. It didn't just appear into thin air. Somebody didn't like just print the money and pass it out. There are people whose minds have changed politically going into the voting booth on November. I didn't put that in, their names in as well. You know, as a reporter, you really have to be careful about using people's names. I always warn them. There's the slightest backlash people have over, you know, an uncombed eyelash. Social media is insane. Yep. But I don't think this is political. I think this is very common sense, the reaction to it. The institution of it is very political, but the reaction to it is common sense.
Well, so there's a guy you mention in the article who is about $30,000 in debt. He has a classical music degree. He didn't even finish his degree. And of course, he's still on the hook for the note. And what interests me was his reaction. You asked him about it, and he said, look, I believe I was taken advantage of, predatory lending and so forth. And growing up, it was pretty clear that there was no other option. But his dad is like a fourth generation tradesman. He's got other options right in front of his face.
Yes.
And it's not a judgment call on this kid. And he's not a kid anymore.
Right.
But it's an observation. People can't see it. He believed, as I'm looking at your article right now, he believed that his unfinished degree in classical music was as legitimate to society as the tax write-offs that somebody might enjoy for purchasing a bulldozer or for the cost the taxpayer foots for building a new road. It's not that he's wrong. It's that he believes he's right, genuinely.
Yes. And it was really interesting as we're having this conversation, there are a bunch of welders behind us, well, behind him in front of me, and they're working on fixing a city street, right? Mm-hmm. They're working on the rebar. They're working on the infrastructure. And he turns and he says, I don't think you, everyone paying, footing the bill for my degree is any different than you footing the bill for those guys getting paid for a new road. I couldn't wrap my head around it.
I can't either, but I think it's important to understand that he can't not wrap his head around it. I don't know how to reach that kid, except other than to say, look, be reasonable. Make a list of people and be as generous as you want that will benefit from your decision to major in classical music and then not finish versus the number of people who might drive on that road. And make a value judgment. I mean, I'm what I want to say is, wait a second. You're not only wrong, you're backwards. Those people building a road that we all use offer a far superior contribution to society. Not that there's anything wrong with classical music. I sang in the opera for 8 years, for God's sakes. I get it. I get it. But come on. Really? All degrees, all training are the same? And they're all the same responsibility to the taxpayer? Really?
Yeah. And, you know, it's the thing that you and I have talked about before, and I write about a lot. These young people, he's 39, so he's young to me. These young people have been sort of immersed within our culture, right? Our cultural curators, our corporations, our institutions, our government, you know, Hollywood all told him that. Of all told him exactly his mindset. It's sort of like when you have a political leader that doesn't have a no man in their room, right? That tells everything that you do is great. Everything you do is great. There's been no one in his life to say, kid, yeah. We have an entire generation of that. We tire a generation of that.
Here's what scares me. I agree with you, except for the part in this kid's case. His name's Jim, by the way. I don't want to just call him the kid, but Jim's dad was right there. Jim's dad was a tradesman.
Yeah.
Jim grew up with Jim's dad. And every single day, Jim's dad showed Jim that, yeah, there are other ways to make a living. What I worry about is that, and I don't know this, this is pure conjecture, apologies if it doesn't apply at all here, but I know a lot of guys like Jim's dad who didn't want Jim to follow in their footsteps. They yes. wanted Jim to go out there into the world to do something better, whatever better means, right? And I wonder, was that happening? Did you sense that?
Yes, yes, he did tell me that. We had a very long interview. What is ironic is that he now works in the same building trade that his dad does at the same union hall. That's his job.
Okay. And he also said that he regrets going to college.
He does regret going to college.
He made a wrong decision in attending college is what you wrote.
Yeah, he did. He did regret it. It's interesting because he did regret it. However, he still has that mindset that is befuddling. Like his realities haven't impacted his lane, as you said, Mike, right? He's still going to stay in that lane, even though reality has taught him a completely, like, you should be in that lane.
Well, I mean, if you're alive in 2022 and looking for work, you better be down with the facts that the lanes are everywhere and they lead in all different directions. And if you're not willing to get in your car and to go to where the work is, well, never mind the consequences of not staying in your lane. What are the consequences of sitting tight and waiting somehow for the opportunities you're looking for to land in your lap? Have you heard of Nick Eberstadt by any chance?
No, tell me about him.
He's a guy, actually, Chuck just recommended him to me. He wrote a book about men who simply haven't, he just wrote an article in the journal about men who didn't go back to work after COVID. But he wrote a book about 6 years before on the same thing. And he's just talking about the fact that there's 7 million men in this country who are not looking for work or working.
Yeah.
And we've never seen anything like it before. There have been men out of work before, but by every past metric, they've been looking for work.
Right.
The number of men who have given up is staggering. Just staggering. And that's the other thing that your article talks, it kind of opens the door for it. You know, this guy, Jim, got very lucky because his old man had a trade he could step into.
Right.
But a lot of people at that point in their life right now, a lot of men in particular, are just throwing up their hands and saying, the hell with it. No more work for me.
They're disappearing into living either with a family member, with their parents. I think that used to be called living on the dole. And there's this just whole snowball effect on our culture by that happening. There's this then next generation. So what if he has children and he marries, right?
Mm-hmm.
What's that generation being taught as an example by their parent? I just think we don't think about these larger cultural impacts. Just the place of men, period, in our culture has become, when we're talking about, you know, in corporations, in Hollywood, in soap operas, even on Hallmark these days, you know, it's sort of been diminished. I don't think any of this is good legacy-wise for what happens with the next generation and the generation after that. We need good examples. We need people, a mother or father or a mother and a father, to show examples of hard work and earning your way up or earning your way wherever you go in your life. And not showing that isn't good for our culture.
No. Look, culture is always upstream of these things, right? I mean, it feels sometimes like it's the other way around, but I've always argued that part of the reason there's so many stigmas and stereotypes and myths and misperceptions around the trades is that the way they've been portrayed in sitcoms and movies and discussed at cocktail parties for many decades has sort of collectively conspired to diminish the whole thing. Yeah. But your point around portrayals of men in general, I think, is super interesting. Maybe we went too far in the 40s and 50s. Maybe the archetypal male was way too one-dimensional and way too predictable. But I think I was watching with my mom, Everybody Loves Raymond. The
right.
first season that came out, it was a really fun show and I enjoyed it. But she kind of pointed out, whatever it is, it's always his fault.
Yes.
Whatever it is,
yeah.
whether it's he forgets to pick up the kids or he gets the cooking wrong or he never really did anything right.
Right.
And once I started looking for that,
yeah.
Jesus, I saw it everywhere.
It is.
Everywhere.
It's so true. It's incredibly true. And that has been the case probably since the early 80s. The betrayal mm-hmm. of men, whether it's in an ad or in a movie or anywhere in Hollywood or on a soap opera, in books, they're almost a throwaway character. We demonize men. We demonize the value a man brings, not just to a relationship, but also to the community. I mean, men in the community, think about Rotary Clubs or Elks mm-hmm. or those kind of do-goody, the JCs, right? These are the kinds of things that we used to lift up and encourage men to join, and scouting, all of that. Fraternal organizations are becoming less and less important in the community. I have no idea what's going on with scouting. I don't even want to know. I was just like afraid to find out. And we've tried to feminize, and not in a negative way, but we've tried to make men and women on the same plane in terms of value. And while value is true, there's also very different aspects between a man and a woman in terms of in the community. And we've made that a taboo subject. Everything
You're
has to be
You're going to get in trouble.
Same.
You can't really
You're
say that anymore.
Get in trouble.
No, I just said it.
Yeah, well, listen.
I'm gonna leave now.
Well, I mean, I want to get your take on everything you just said vis-a-vis, well, your demography, the Appalachia. Because, you know, I think about what's so tragic there is that, I'm going to generalize horribly, but the work ethic is so ingrained in the identity of a man.
Right.
In that part, right?
Yeah.
Generalizing, folks, forgive me. I'm not saying there's no work ethic in women. I'm not saying that at all. I'm saying the part of the identity of a man in the part of our country that Selena covers is wrapped up in work.
Yeah.
And to see opportunity vanish in those areas and to see all these things happen in those areas, it must be particularly poignant to run into people who just are looking around as though their cheese has been literally moved. What happened in these towns? What happened in these communities?
Yeah, it's incredibly sad. A number of things happened in these towns and these communities. First of all, trade deals. And both parties did really bad trade deals. These trade deals took away the soul of their communities, those centers of work. I mean, you would drive into a town like Youngstown. Youngstown, Ohio is a perfect example. In fact, we're coming up in a couple of days on the 45th anniversary of Black Monday. What's Black Monday? Black Monday is September 19th, the day when 15,000 men, mostly men, lost their jobs up and down the Steel Valley, all in one day. All in one day. And the thing that always sort of hit me first, I think a senior in high school. The thing that hit me first is you didn't hear the hum of the machines anymore in town. And to me as a young person, I was like, that meant work. That meant people were, you know,
right.
people had jobs, and the kids I went to high school with, their dads had jobs. And everything changed at that moment. We have not only not recovered, our government has done everything to make sure to make that punishment permanent in terms of not finding ways to bring back jobs of value. These were well-paying jobs. They could send their kids off to a trade school or to college where they could have a cottage up at Lake Erie, right? Or a boat so they could go fishing. They did not have an extravagant life, but they had the middle class life, and it was very aspirational. And these communities were centered on the Little League games and the Sandlot football games and the churches, the guilds that all sort of interwoven and made these communities so strong. And when they took away the heart of it, not only did they take away all those manufacturing jobs, but then the barber had to leave because nobody's haircut to cut anymore. The machine shop that fixed everything, the car dealership, we rotted the places diner from the inside out. In our zest for technology and the push for college education, we've forced the young people out. All that is left are skeletons of these cities.
Oh, God. In no way do I want to, in any way, diminish the importance of a job that pays a wage that allows all of this to happen. I get that. But what happens to the conversation when you reduce work to nothing but this transactional deal between an employer and an employee?
Right.
To me, and this goes to a labor management thing, we talked about it last week. I probably lost a few friends as a result. But what I meant to say is that it just seems like when we talk about work and labor today, the only thing we talk about is the size of the paycheck. And when we do that, and it's important, but when we do that to the exclusion of all of the other things, then the door opens wide to conversations about universal basic income and all sorts of other things, all sorts of other things that presuppose the notion that work is nothing but a paycheck. And that makes me nervous.
Well, yeah, the things about manufacturing, if we just stick with manufacturing or we stick with coal or natural gas, the thing about those kinds of jobs, or a welder or the people that build bridges, build roads, right? They all view in different ways, but it always comes back that they feel patriotic. And people say, what do you mean patriotic? But I get it. Because they're doing something that's making their town better. It's making their neighborhood better. They're building the bridge that eventually the president of the United States is going to drive over when it comes to visit town, right? And they're all were very cognizant of some being part of something bigger than themselves. And there was a lot of pride that went into that job. And that spilled over into the community. I can't even sort of emphasize enough how much these jobs weren't just jobs. There was this interwoven fabric that no matter what you did in this town, it was interlocking and interconnecting, and you were all part of something bigger than yourselves.
Real quick, I think I can explain the thing you're talking around, or at least offer a theory, and it brings Jim back into the conversation, our classical music major, 30 grand in the hole, who actually genuinely believes his debt is as legitimate as the cost of putting in a road. You know, part of what's missing and part of what you're talking about is art. And before shop class was simply taken out of high schools overnight, it was called the vocational arts.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
And this kid, Jim, he probably saw himself as an artist for a time as he was studying. And I'm not trying to make his case for him, but I do think it's interesting to point out that in the same way a man working on a bridge might take pride in the fact that the president could one day traverse it, we also have a guy studying classical music who might one day sing the national anthem in a stadium where the president is seated. Right. And that might be a place to sort of retrench to and say, look, when you take the art out of the vocation,
yes,
all you're left with is the brute realities of the work. In the same way that when you take the joy of work out of the labor, all you're left with is a paycheck. And I kind of feel like somewhere in all of this, if you can draw a line for me, draw it between the banishment of home ec and shop class from high schools with this current level of disaffectation you write about every week.
Oh, yeah. I mean, home ec started falling off out of favor probably mid-80s, right? that's when the collapse of the steel industry, the collapse of manufacturing in this country. And the edict that went out through the school counselors was, you're going to college. That's it. You're going to college. Everybody's going to college. And there's all these incredibly talented artisans that don't fit in the college mold, that want to go do this other thing. But this other thing, all those jobs are either gone or moved seven states away and they can't be close to their family. And a lot of people just got lost. And when they got lost, they got stuck. And not only did we, you know, take those abilities to take a shop class, which, or home ec, by the way, do you know how many young people don't know how to write a check? They don't know how to write a check.
That's right. A lot of young people don't use checks anymore. Well, they pay everything online.
It's Venmo. It's, you know, tap the card. Yeah. It's magic.
I'm very uncomfortable with that. It's just like, where's my money going? It's, I don't see it leaving. But also even basic home ec, so you can know how to boil water and put pasta in there and cook, right? Those skills are incredibly important. Or knowing how to have a budget. You know how many young people don't, for an entire generation didn't learn, oh, wait, I'm supposed to budget my money? I thought I'd just spend it until my paycheck was gone, and then I have to live on ramen noodles until the next paycheck. Like, there's no concept of a budget, where the three of us probably grew up with our parents like doing the budget every 2 weeks. They laid it out on the dining room table, all their little envelopes with all their little, you know, their money for this, allotted for this and for that. And it worked. And we took that away from them. Now, there has been a resurgence in steering young people, in particular in Appalachia, towards the trades. Now, that has a lot to do with the natural gas industry, which, by the way, isn't just in Pennsylvania. It's, you know, Colorado, Texas, and New Mexico, right?
Oklahoma.
It's a booming Oklahoma, right? This is like just this amazing industry that, by the way, has reduced our carbon footprint and does not exceed it. We have seen a resurgence. My young nephew Gianni is taking shop. In fact, he got admitted into a city school. There's now like this, only a certain amount of people can go to certain schools, but because he had an interest in a trade, they took him. Yeah. And so I see a light at the end of the tunnel. And around here, natural gas has also played a huge part in Votech. There is a high school in Waynesburg, Greene County, Pennsylvania. They have a Votech program that if you get accepted into it as a sophomore, when you walk out of high school as a senior, you walk with your cap and gown on the stage, out the door, and you are making $85,000 a year. And that is the poorest county in this state. And you are now able to buy a house that lives near your grandparents and your parents, and you are able to give back to your community. Those are the kinds of aspirational events that makes communities better and stronger, but also gives these young artisans the ability to do their trade without feeling guilty because they didn't go to college.
And by the way, look, your art, your craft is such a huge part of this as well. You must tell their stories, Selena. You must tell their stories, and these headlines must appear in giant fonts, and you must drip. You must drip upon the rest of the country as you're doing. You've said artisans now a couple of times, and not to belabor the point, but I was struck listening as you talked about the way we used to have virtually three choices all of the time. NBC, ABC, CBS. Then comes Fox and you have four, right? MCI, AT&T, Sprint. Like, life is about three choices. It's let's make a deal. One, two, and three. So many people are stuck today because somehow the third choice has vanished. And so what does the artisan do? The man or woman who didn't go to college, but who is nevertheless skilled, who approaches his or her work like an art. They don't fit in the uneducated column, and they don't fit in the post-baccalaureate column. So they get lost. Right. And as you were talking about that, I was thinking here in California, we've waged a war on jobbers, on freelancers, the gig economy, which I think is terrific because it opens the door to entrepreneurship and freelance. But that column has been eliminated. Here now, you either own a business, making you a greedy, rapacious capitalist, or you're an employee, making you basically an oppressed class. There's no middle ground for somebody with a very specific kind of ambition to occupy and maneuver from. It seems to me that Appalachia, of all places, is one of the best examples where the middle ground has just vanished.
Yeah, that's very sad. I just got back from driving across the country. I do that twice a year. I usually do vertical and then a horizontal. I will tell you that these trips, again, took a back road. I took a road. Let me tell you about this one road in Colorado. It was only 39 miles long, and yet it took me 3.5 hours to drive it. Why? Because it was all dirt, and it was all over the side of the mountain, and I wasn't quite sure I was going to end up over the side of the mountain. But I always meet the most inspirational and aspirational people on these trips. And I come back feeling refreshed and feel hope, because the people that make this country work, that do those small entrepreneurial things that you're talking about, like the guy I met who's a gunsmith. This is my favorite. Well, I shouldn't say favorite because it's awful. I'm going to be writing about this. Do you know how hard it is to get a bank loan to start a business to be a gunsmith?
Well, I think that would depend somewhat on what state you're in. But by and large, I'm going to go with difficult.
Yeah. Even in my state, it's almost impossible. You want to sell guns? I don't think so. Not in our country. Do you want to make drill bits for the natural gas industry? I'm sorry.
Not here.
We're not going to give you a loan. I have a big piece coming out about that. We are punishing entrepreneurs, people who contribute to our country. We are punishing them because they're not adhering to the social justice and the climate justice corporate and banking ideology. I am stunned by this. Now, these people are finding ways to just start their business just in their garage, in their house, just in a small building they put in the back of their house, because the banking industry is refusing to give them loans because they're not social justice conformist.
That brings up an interesting point about people with money who are not giving loans. Who gave Jim a loan to go to school?
Right.
Why didn't they say, hey, are you really going to be able to make this money back? We have a loan system for education that doesn't put any consideration into the fact that, not a social justice cause or anything, an economic equation.
Just what's the cost benefit?
Yeah.
If a classical music degree costs this, how much can your average musical classicist expect to make with that degree?
Exactly.
That's a question that is never asked.
Not allowed to ask that.
It used to be before the federal government got involved in the student loan program. It used to be when private money was going to loan, you had to sit across the table from someone who looked you over and said, geez, I don't know if French literature is really, I don't know if I can loan you $100,000 to study that. And somebody would say no, but no one says no. You can study anything you want. You can study why Seinfeld is funny. There are classes about
that. Let me know if
that.
You figure that one out.
What is the deal with Seinfeld?
That was really good.
It's not bad. Chuck's an artist, you see. It's really his only skill.
My degree paid off.
To your point, it was the community bank that gave the loan. It was a guy who sat in the pew next to your dad, shoulder to shoulder, or collected the money, or was your little league coach, right? Like, your banker knew you. That's why I go to a very small bank, very tiny bank. My bank knows me. I know my bank.
Man, this is a whole nother thing, Selena, because you know what? I mean, it's very difficult. Chuck, you teed it up, and you'll probably regret this based on what I'm about to say. But when
here we go.
Well, when you look at Freddie and Fannie Mac, right, and you look at what happens with the student loans and how they get bundled and how they get sold, right? Yeah. They get sold way down. You know, I think David Sedaris wrote a really funny story where he talks about Freddie and Fannie Mac. They sound like your wacky uncle and your aunt somewhere, kind of rich and eccentric, and they're here to help you out. No, they are faceless pimps and thieves who live at the end of a long plastic hallway in the middle of some towering glass edifice in Kansas, right? Well, hello, mortgage-backed securities. I mean, what the hell do we think really happened back in 2008? We were telling people that if they were living in an apartment, they were essentially being abused.
Yeah.
And there was
you
no
deserve
reason.
A house.
There's no reason why anyone shouldn't have a home.
Yes.
Never mind the redlining. Never mind the racial stuff. I get it. I understand I'm painting with a broad brush. But the argument, Selena,
right.
The argument that everybody deserves and needs to live in a home is not so askance from everybody deserves and needs to have a 4-year degree. And once you convince the individual that there's some sort of truth in that mumbo jumbo, then the money will flow until it blows up in our faces. And we got guys like Jim who don't know what to do with $30,000 of red ink. It kills me.
The entitlement that so many people have, like I'm entitled to go to college. I'm entitled to own a house. Where I brought my kids up, like you earn. You want a house? Fine. Earn enough money to buy a house. Don't buy a house that's outside of your league. Don't buy this extravagant, whatever the case may be. And that's how I was brought up as well. But everybody, this is an entitlement world. You're entitled to that house. Doesn't matter if you can't afford it. Doesn't matter if you don't pay your mortgage. You are entitled to that.
I can't find any sympathy for the person you just described, but I don't want to pile on. So where can I offer some sympathy, right? Maybe it's in the fact that this guy, Jim, he says he really didn't see any other options. And look, personally, beyond my ranting, I do believe that the pressure we've put on a generation of kids is unspeakable. Mm-hmm. And it's coming from all sides, Selena.
Yep.
Teachers, parents, peers.
Guidance
counselors are getting bonused based on the number of kids in their charge who wind up going to college as opposed to trade schools. So if you're a 17-year-old, never mind the entitlement. The entitlement will come later.
Right.
If it comes at all. Just think about the pressure.
Yeah.
Where is the voice of reason? Where is the person going, hey, easy there, Sparky.
Yeah.
Let's do a little cost-benefit analysis. So I understand in the absence of that, people who look at their giant student debt today are going to put their hand out and say, look, I got sold a bill of goods.
Yeah.
So somebody somewhere help me. I understand that. But
I do too, Mike. I'm glad that you brought it up because that's kind of what I was getting at with the idea of no one is there to say, is this really a good idea? The cost benefit, no one's there to measure that and put it out in front of you. And I'm not saying that the people who are signing for these loans are victims or anything of the kind, but I am saying that they were pressured by teachers, guidance counselors, parents who all said, go to college, go to college, go to college. You can't do anything with your life unless you go to college. You can't do anything with your life unless you go to college. Okay, how do I go to college? Sign here. Okay. And they got themselves in without thinking those things through. I'm not saying that they're not responsible, but I think there's a bigger Uncle Sam type person to share some blame here.
How about the university, Selena? How about $50 billion in endowments at Harvard? I mean, why do we go to the taxpayer first?
Yes.
Yeah. It's absolutely insane. And let's step back and look at my profession for a minute. The best journalist I have ever worked with never went to college. They were just really good writers and really knew how to find the story.
Tell me about that person. Who specifically are you talking about?
My editor at the Trib years ago, Sandy Tolliver. She didn't go to college. I have never worked under a better editor in my entire career. And I saw her work her way up from being the cops reporter and then covering school boards and then covering City Hall and then working her way into being the city desk editor until eventually becoming one of the managing editors of the newspaper. And she had gut and she had instinct and she knew how to tell a story and take the BS out when the BS needed to be taken out.
And she doesn't get hired today. She doesn't get hired today, Selena.
No, she doesn't.
She doesn't have a degree.
Most newspapers require an Ivy League degree.
I feel like screaming, Chuck. You mind?
Go ahead. Go ahead.
It's so heartbreaking when you think about the waste of talent. The number of people today who could be, in relative terms, in any number of companies who are just like Sandy Toliver, who have smarts, ambition, natural talent, gumption, and a work ethic to beat the band. Those people today, I'm sorry to have to say it like this, but they are under assault. They are not valued. They are not sought. They are not encouraged. And they are not rewarded. People say to us all the time, work ethic scholarships, why? Well, because who else is doing it? How do we find the next Sandy Toliver? That's what every employer worth her or his salt should be asking themselves today.
To this day, if she reads a story of mine, and she pretty faithfully does, and sends me a note and says, good job, Zito, because I was always, she was the kind of boss where you wanted to do a really good job. And she is in my head, like she occupies a space in my head every day when I write, even though I don't answer to her anymore. Why?
Yeah. Hey, wait a minute, that's my job.
She always demands the best from me. And so when I get a note, like I did about my the story that you were in, Mike, she was like, good job, Zito. I'm like, thank you, Jesus.
Isn't that funny?
Yeah, nothing like a good attaboy or attagal, I should say.
Yeah.
From, and Chuck, this is the thing, attaboys get cheapened when they come from sources you neither respect nor admire.
Yeah.
It has to come from somebody who earned your trust. And how do they do that? You know, how does a woman like Sandy Toliver, it's an honest question, how does anybody earn that level of respect? The level of respect that you feel for her, what did she do along the way to really engender that in you? I bet it wasn't a whole bunch of attaboys.
Oh, no, I was terrified.
Yeah, right.
She knows
it was
that.
More like, are you kidding me?
I was
really?
Terrified. I was like, is my lead good? Do I have enough sources? Did I spell that right? I'm the best reporter in the world because I'm dyslexic. So I'm always turning things inside out. I was terrified to get it wrong. You know what, guys? This program has drained my battery. Can I plug my computer in?
Oh, well, yeah, for God's sakes. It's just getting
interesting. I just noticed that. I was like, oh.
Super quick. Yeah, you better take care of that.
Yeah, go plug yourself in. She's awesome. We love Selena.
Selena Zito.
She's such a good reporter. She's such a good interview. She literally nearly talked her battery right into extinction right now. Mm-hmm. I'm glad she saw that. And you vanished for a while, Chuck. I could hear you, but I couldn't see you.
Is that right?
Just so you know. Yeah.
Yeah, you
are. Is that your hutch I'm looking at?
This is a set she's built just for this podcast.
You know what, dude? The woman travels constantly. There's no reason for me to assume that you're home.
Oh, you know what? That's fair.
There you go. Sorry about that. That was great theater. Mm-hmm. So when I talk about artisans, one of my favorite places in, well, it's about an hour outside of Western Pennsylvania in Newell, West Virginia, is Fiesta Wear. Are you familiar with Fiesta Wear at all?
Oh, it sounds like fancy underpants, but tell me more.
No. This is beautiful, colorful. Can you see the dishes?
Uh-huh.
Oh, yeah.
And you can see all the colors over there. They're famous, and the last pottery in America. It's the last American manufacturing pottery in America. And I went in there and watched them make everything. These are true artisans. They love what they do.
My favorite part was how you pronounced C-O-L-O-R.
Oh.
Keller.
Oh, yeah.
These Kellers over here. These bright Kellers.
It's my one Yinzer word. I try to never
Kellers.
Say that one.
Kellers. So many beautiful Kellers. I honestly didn't pick it up, Chuck. I thought there was a hiccup in the audio. That's actually what she sounds like when she
says. I'm
going
to go. I have shame.
You're not going anywhere.
You know
I love it. I love it.
It's actually the perfect observation to make, given the fact that we're 56 minutes into this thing. These artisans you're talking about who are working for the last pottery makers in the nation at Fiestaware.
Yeah.
I wonder how many of them have four-year degrees.
Not many, not at all. I have done several. I'll send you guys a story, or people can go to selinazio.com. There's a ton of stories about Fiestaware because I have a slight obsession. They've been around since 1875. Mm-hmm. They're East Liverpool, Ohio, Newell, West Virginia, right there. And at one time, East Liverpool, Ohio was the pottery capital of the world. 300 different potteries companies were located in that town. Now there's just one.
No kidding.
There's very few people there that have a degree. They make a good living there. They work hard. The plant is the exact same plant that it was in the 1890s. Have you ever seen a wooden brick floor?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. It's so awesome.
Yeah.
That was to keep their feet. And it's covered in creosote, so, you know, it won't catch on fire.
Yeah.
But there is such pride in every piece, every dish. If you have any Fiestaware listeners, I suspect you will, people are going to go crazy that I'm talking about this because it's like a cult.
I'll tell you what happened last time you came on here. All kinds of crap blew up.
Oh, no.
My guess is Fiestaware is going to get bombarded. I'm guessing Fiestaware.com. But friends, you heard it here. If you want to really dive into some one-of-a-kind pottery and some amazing Keelers, then you want to go over there to Fiestaware.
Keller. And, it's Keller, Mike.
Keller.
I'm never saying that word in public again. Never.
Selina, hey. Since you brought up your website, selinazito.com, that's S-A-L-E-N-A-Z-I-T-O.com, I understand you got a few subscribers after the last time you were on the podcast. You got a final tally on that?
219,000.
Holy crap.
That was awesome.
I didn't know we had that many listeners. That's
your
amazing.
Listeners are really like, they send me notes, they email like, oh, I love that story. I'm like, oh, I live there.
That's
it's
great.
Just, it's very engaging. I have three full-time jobs. I am a daily reporter for the Washington Examiner. I am a columnist for the New York Post, and I'm also a columnist for the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette. So you can find all my stuff there. And if
well,
you
I'll tell you what else you are. You're my mom's friend.
I love your mom.
I would be remiss if I didn't thank you and encourage our listeners to go read the article you wrote about Peggy Rowe. With your help, vacuuming in the nude and other ways to get attention wound up, I'd like to say, on the top of the New York Times list, but their bestseller list doesn't really rank bestsellers. She sold more than anybody else on the list and came in at number 11. But she's always a bestseller to me. I hope she didn't take too much of your time because she can get pretty mouthy.
She was awesome. We talked for like an hour and 20 minutes.
Oh my God.
I took a different approach with her story. I talked a little bit about the book, but mostly I just talked about her.
Her life.
I think her life story is really interesting. And that's the kind of storytelling I like to do. Bring the reader into the living room with the person that I'm interviewing and feel like they're setting a spell, right? And they're just talking back and forth, yapping, chewing the fat, whatever you want to call it. Mm-hmm. And that's how I tried to present the story with your mom. And she was a blast. And I really, really enjoyed her a lot. Your
well,
dad
thanks.
Was very funny too. He needed to know how to turn on the stove while we were interviewing, which was adorable. And she's like, he's not really good in the kitchen. And I put that in the story because that's part of who she is, right? Yeah. I feel like there's an obligation when I tell a story is to put everything in there and let the reader sort of drink it in and understand the people that I have the honor to interview.
Well, Selina, that's only the hardest thing in the world to do. And I'm not great at it. I love to sum up. I love to connect the dots, but great writers, in my view, and for that matter, maybe even especially great journalists, they don't connect the dots. They just put the dots out there and give us room. They give us room to form an opinion, make a conclusion. I don't mind being led, but I don't want to be lectured, and I don't want to be scolded. And even on a Sunday, I don't really want a sermon. I like what you did with my mom's article also because you captured – the thing that's under her success, which everybody talks to me about work ethic. They should be talking to her because she did this. She wrote every day for 60 years before she really got the time of day. To see a reporter of your caliber paying attention to that across three platforms, you're welcome on this podcast anytime.
There's a brightness in your mom, right? There's a brightness that isn't directing a light at you, but draws you towards her. And I think that is her great gift. And I doubt that she lectured you about work ethic. However, I believe that she showed you. And that's what I tried to bring out in the story. She didn't tell you to, I suspect. She didn't nag you about it. She led by example. And that brightness, that thing in her, I think is what makes her incredibly special. She's a great storyteller, but also that she impacts other people.
Well, like you, and maybe to some extent me, the real reason I wanted to talk to you for the first time was that in the nonfiction world, Dirty Jobs was pretty unique in the sense that I never really weighed in on anything until I tried it. I thought that George Plimpton, a man of letters, actually did a great job of immersing himself in the story before he formed an opinion. You do the same thing.
Yeah.
My mom does the same thing.
Yeah.
And I think I realize now, the longer I live, the more impressed I am with people who actually go to where the story is, go to where the work is, who walk a mile in the shoes, right, before they write a Yelp review under the footwear section.
Yeah.
I'm glad you're doing that.
Thank you. Some of the most poignant places that I've been were probably not very remarkable to other people. But when you go in that elevator and you go 1,200 feet under the ground and you go back 7 miles and you cross over three states to go to the coal wall, just so that piece of coal in 7 hours can be turning the light on at your church, you really appreciate the people that do those jobs.
Wow.
Those people are the reason your lights are on today. Those people are the reason why you can go into the store or the county courthouse or to your church. And so if I don't do it, if I just sit in front of a computer and write about it, then I don't have all those tangible experiences to write about. The other place that I love to go, I have this series coming out after the election on these lost notes from Baptist churches, which is just an amazing story. I still have a lot more reporting to do on it.
Tell me, though, what I'm all in. Lost notes from Baptist churches.
It's this music that hasn't, outside of some of these Baptist churches in Maryland and Virginia and all the way down south, these very old churches, both Black Baptist and White Baptist churches, outside of that congregation, nobody has heard this incredible music. It's the way the notes are used. And these hymnals date back to the 18th century. And these congregations are carrying on that tradition. And they're not letting it get lost. It's almost like a lost language, except it's music.
Tell me more. Like, are you talking about a note that's not on the pentatonic scale, not A, B, C, D, E, F, G?
Yeah.
Something in between that's not even a half step, but some quarter tone, something like that?
Yes.
Really?
Yeah. I've heard of this, Chuck. It's super. It's not like throat singing, which is its own crazy thing, but it's its own thing, and it doesn't sound like anything else you've ever heard before.
No, it doesn't. I get goosebumps just talking about it. When I first walked in, I love to go to different churches. I am a practicing Catholic. My faith is incredibly important to me. But I was taught long ago by Sister Mary Grace at Holy Ghost Academy, you should learn about other religions. It only makes your faith stronger. And so in my reporting, I always try to go to a different church or a temple or whatever. Baptists have always fascinated me just because when I walk out there, I'm like, I have so much Jesus in me right now. Like, oh my God, I have 4 hours of Jesus and everyone's singing and crying and it's amazing.
Yeah.
And so I just happened upon this So I'm doing a lot of research. It's going to take me months to write this story. I can't wait. There'll be music. There'll be video. I'm so excited about it.
Is there a place people could go online right now and listen to an example of what you're talking about? Because No. That's why it's probably lost. Lost notes from Baptist churches.
Not until I write the story.
All right. Wow. I got it.
Look forward to that.
You know what? I will send you the link to one YouTube thing that I did find. Now that I think about that, it's kind of fuzzy, but it does capture it. But the person that was taking the video was not very good at it. So they're like bouncing around with music.
Sure. It's a thing, though, Chuck. You can take a real deep dive on YouTube with old gospel quartets.
Yes.
There's so many of them. And you can see the impact they had in Appalachia for sure, but all over the country. I mean, it's a giant rabbit hole. You'll spend a lot of time in it, but I have not gone down the Baptist church thing. I can't wait.
I can't wait to do this story. I'm pretty excited about that. That, and I have a story about moonshine coal. People doing illegal coal mines. That's pretty funny.
I love it. Moonshine coal.
And there is a big difference between going down an elevator in a coal mine and crawling in a hole. Let me just tell you. I was like, I really don't want to do this.
Yeah. Listen,
but I didn't want to do it.
Western Pennsylvania, we went to, bituminous. We did anthracite. Went down a couple of miles. I can't think of anything, Selena, that has been such a whipsaw of emotion and public from respect to approbation.
Yes.
Right?
Mm.
Coal miners were heroes.
Yes.
In our lifetimes, they were widely recognized as the people who made civilized life possible for the rest of us. And my God, how far have those people fallen?
And now they need to learn to code.
Yeah, now they need to learn to code. That's right.
Oh, they are considered literally an enemy.
Yeah.
In our culture. And man, these guys work hard and they're proud, and women. I had one woman in the story. She was the only woman coal miner and she was pregnant. And she was going down that coal mine, and those guys, man, they had her back.
Oh, yeah.
They had her back. And I just absolutely just loved that whole sense of community that these guys have. It was a Harvey mine in Washington County in Western Pennsylvania.
Rothamel was the guy I knew, Steve Rothamel. He was on Dirty Jobs and, third generation coal miner and the things you can learn. I wish when you were talking to my mom, you had told her about your church thing. Because when my brothers and I went to her, I was 12, maybe 13, just rebellious as hell. And I'd been going to the church. Her dad built the church I grew up in. Boy Scout meetings in the basement, Lenten dinners every Wednesday night, weddings. All of it. Well, what she didn't tell you was that I went to her one day and I'm like, Mom, I've had it. You know, I'm 12 years old. There's really not much more for me to learn in this life, being very wise and prescient. And I've made some decisions regarding my personal faith and my own journey. And I'm done with this. Okay. I'm just done with this.
You're 12.
At 12. Yeah. Because I was very smart, Selena. You see, I mean, I knew everything there was to know at 12. And my dad said, look, kiddo, that's not on the list of things you can choose to do. Now, if you don't want to be a Reformed Presbyterian, and if you don't want to go to Kenwood United Presbyterian, that's fine. But you're going to go somewhere. And so it was my mother who stepped in. And for a summer, my brothers and I went on the great try it out religion. If religion were a thing that money could buy, the rich would live and the poor would die. That's the first song I sang in a Baptist church in like 1974.
That's awesome.
I swear to God. And then the next Sunday we'd go, what are these Lutherans up to? What about the Methodists? What about the Catholics? All the stooping and the kneeling and the stuff.
Oh,
and we
yeah.
did all that. But my favorite, not to hijack the conversation, but have you been to a Unitarian church?
Oh, yes.
Oh, my God. Chuck, this one was up in up in Hunt Valley somewhere. So we're up in the county. We're in horse country. It's like 68 degrees on a Sunday morning. The windows are open. The cool breeze is blowing in off a cornfield. Everybody's, it's a party. And the woman, there's a woman who's the preacher, right? Remember, it's 1974, so I'm like, what the
heck? What is that allowed?
What is this? She walks out and says, please turn to hymn number 49 in your hymn books, 49. And the congregation commences to singing, Oh, What a Beautiful Morning from Oklahoma.
Oh, my God.
No, shall we gather at the river? No, nearer my God to thee? No, old rugged cross. The Unitarians went with, There's a bright golden haze on the meadow. Unbelievable. And I loved it. I'm like, oh, my God, religion with musical theater? I'm in.
How did your summer of, what was it, bar hopping, church hopping go? Where did you end up?
Yeah, well, it culminated, myself and my entire family now are Scientologists. That's what happened. I'm kidding, of course. No?
I tried to keep my poker face.
Good job, Selena.
I tried.
Wasn't for me, the Scientology thing. I gave him a look. Wasn't for me.
Okay, Duke.
What's the name of the planet? Nobody's supposed to know, Chuck. The ultimate
Xenon?
Xenon? It's pretty close to Zeno, which I think is a pretty good place to end this. Selena Xeon, taking her career in a bold new direction.
Scientology, yay! I actually went in, they have like this, I was in D.C., I forget, was it 2008? Right before the election, and I was like, I don't forget what I was covering. I hated going to D.C. They had this big, they had this open house, and it was the Scientology office. And I'm like, you know, I've tried everything else. I'll just go in and see what's going on. Those people are weird. I'm sorry.
You've said so many things that would get a normal person canceled in the last 90 minutes, but...
So canceled.
Instead, you'll get 1,000 more people to sign up for SelenaZito.com.
Yeah. Honestly, go there. The woman writes fairly fearlessly. She travels all over the place. I really appreciate you doing what you're doing. Thanks for throwing my mom a bone there. That was awesome. And more importantly, keep telling the stories of the people we used to venerate, but now disparage. I think it's rather important.
Thank you. Keep doing what you're doing. I love your show on Fox. I watched the one repeat the other night because I didn't see it the first time with the North Carolina policeman.
Oh, yeah.
That was really good.
Wilmington, North Carolina. Yeah. That was the first episode of season two. We all sat down and we were like, look, this thing's a hit. How America Works, Fox Business. Yeah. We've got a new season coming up. But we were like, what do you want to do? And I said, honestly, this time, I don't know that there's ever been a tougher time to be a cop. Let's just be a fly on the wall with some good cops and see how their week is. And Fox Biz was like, absolutely, let's do it. And we got the thing on the air. And I've heard from so many cops. I mean, I don't have to tell you this. You know, when you write honestly and fairly about people who willingly put on a uniform, whether it's to mine coal or run into a burning building or protect and serve, you hear from them. They appreciate it.
Yeah, I love the show. I really enjoy it. I sometimes just like scoot into bed, put it on because they run it back to back on, I think it's Sunday nights.
I think it's Mondays.
Or is it Monday nights? Monday nights? Whatever.
Monday
nights.
But you probably DVR it. Look, the important thing is you're in bed watching me.
All right.
If there's a better way to end this.
You know.
Yeah. Don't worry. I'm going to cut all this out. Don't worry about it. Yeah, we'll never
He's going to cut it into the open, is what he's going to do.
Yeah, I know. He's going to lead with this. No, but make sure you lead with me saying C-O-L-O-R.
Killer.
Because I'm never saying that word again.
Keller. Keller.
Can't say it.
We got to go, but one last thanks to Sandy Tulliver for setting the bar high in a way that made old Selena jump for it. We appreciate that, too. All right.
Thanks.
Adios.
Thanks, guys.
If you like what you heard,
and even if you don't,
oh, won't you please,
pretty please,
subscribe.
Well, I hate to beg and I hate to plead, but please, pretty freaking please subscribe.